From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Native plantings are a giant part of the equation in supporting pollinators, but many other smaller efforts that we can make with other ornamental plants and even the edibles we choose to grow can add up too. I was delighted to see the latest Uprising Seeds Company catalog was themed Pollinate, and that's our topic today, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Brian Campbell with Christine Goldberg grows organic seed at Uprising Seeds in Bellingham, Washington. And he's my guest today to talk about some of his favorite plants on the farm that are always abuzz with beneficial insect life. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
Thanks, Margaret. Thanks for having us back.
Yeah, I've missed talking to you guys, and I still remember how you taught me to grow better beets, for instance, one of the lessons I've gotten from you over the years. So thank you for that.
Good.
I'm a beet queen, so
I love
my beets. and I'll include a link to that conversation, that past conversation, in the transcript to this show. But how many years now have you guys been at it at Uprising?
Yeah, so we've been farming out here in Northwest Washington for about 15 years.
Wow.
And I think this is our 12th catalog we've put out, starting from like a little threefold brochure of a couple of offerings to what we have, what we put out now, which is, I think, up to about 350.
Plus about 350. And how big is the farm?
So we farm about 5 acres actively. We lease about 8 acres, about a half an hour north of Bellingham, right up against the Canadian border. About five of that is actively worked, and maybe three of that to four goes to actual cropping every year, with some rotated out every year for some cover cropping and soil building.
So I should say that I love the illustrations in the current catalog. I think they're by an artist friend of yours, and again, to go with this theme, Pollinate. Can we give credit to her? It's a woman.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we were really really happy to meet Yasna Guy, who's an artist living in North Vancouver, and we just stumbled across her quietly posting just really wonderful, kind of mind-blowing art on Instagram, and started a dialogue with her, and she's been, I think for the past 6 or 7 years now, exploring insects, especially bees and other pollinators, and also really fascinating botanical studies of the floral resources that that those pollinators depend upon.
Yeah.
Motivated, I think, to some degree initially by colony collapse and the honeybee crisis, but has since then really delved into native pollinators as well, and a lot of our native bees that we're really rich in out here in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, they're very dreamy, intimate pictures, so I recommend people take a peek. I'll give the URL, of course, of the catalog of Uprising and so forth with the transcript. But so now, just to disclaim, you know, we're going to talk about pollination or pollen, plants with pollen, flowering things that beneficial insects like. But neither one of us, Brian, is an entomologist or, you know, specializing in phylogenetics, you know, the study of the evolutionary history and relationships among, you know, organisms, like what insect co-evolved with what species of plant. That's not what we're talking about. But we both grow a lot of things. And, of course, as gardeners and farmers, and especially seed farmers, notice some things are really a buzz, you know, more than others. And so, you know, because you're a seed farmer, you let everything go to flower. You let it go through its sexual reproductive phase. Otherwise, you wouldn't get seed, right?
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah. That's pretty much the crux of what's happening in our place is pollination. So, I mean, yeah, like you said, I mean, we don't consider ourselves experts or anything, but they're also, you know, our biggest unpaid staff workers are the pollinators that we depend on, so we really pay attention.
I like that, unpaid staff workers. That's very funny, actually.
I mean, they get something out of the deal as well, too, of course. But but yeah, no, I'd say, you know, of what we grow, and probably true of the vast majority of the food crops and ornamental flower crops, you know, 95% of them are probably dependent on insect pollination. And I can only off the top of my head really think of a handful that don't benefit in some way from pollinator populations.
So give us sort of pretend it's not winter, pretend it's the season, the peak season, things that are in flower everywhere on the farm. So give us sort of a, help us get a visual slash audio in our mind's eye or ear. What's it like, you know, on those five planted acres when so many crops are all in flower at the same time? It must be like an epic symphony of insects.
Yeah, it's really fun to bring people out, even, you know, market farmers who are used to being around production farms, because it's just a totally different looking kind of operation. It's, you know, starts in early spring with the biennials, and it's just kind of waves of blooms pretty much right up until late summer and into fall even.
Hmm. The sound must
just
be amazing.
People who are used to, you know, 8-inch tall radish greens, we've got, you know, 5-foot tall, 5-foot wide radishes that need to be staked and are just covered with blossoms. And a lot of what people's associations of plants, what plants look like in their edible form, just bear, you know, no resemblance to once they've sort of matured and reached their full height and flowering glory.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, I once, I think it was, I don't know how many years ago, it must be a dozen years ago, I think I had a row of parsnips, maybe. I think it was parsnips. And, you know, I must have missed one or more that were, when I was digging, I must have missed some. And they, I don't know what happened, but must have either a seed sowed the next year or the thing sprouted. I guess, is that a biennial? I think it would be a biennial, yes. Is it? So one must have been buried under the ground, and it survived, and it sprouted the next year, and it went through its reproductive. And it was this, like, incredible, giant, beautiful, yellow thing, flower head. And, you know, and so it was like, after that, I just thought, well, let's this happen every year. Like, this is amazing. You know,
it's really like the above ground biomass that I found is really pretty, like, a stupendous volume of stuff.
Yeah.
And we grow a couple things on larger scales that we supply a couple other seed catalogs. And when you get, you know, a quarter acre of arugula in flower that's 5 foot tall and just pretty much, you know, a solid volume of 30 foot by 5 foot by 300 foot volume of flowers all at once, it's really pretty spectacular sight.
So when I do talk to botanists and entomologists about, you know, what are good, quote, pollinator plants, you know, one family of herbaceous plants that's always tops on everyone's list for pollinator interest is sort of the daisy or sunflower relatives, you know, the composites. So are any of those on sort of your hit parade in the catalog or things that you, you know, are featuring and have noticed a lot of interaction with?
Yeah, for sure. Like Rudbeckias, for example, are very popular. I think a lot of those, both the sunflower family and also the umbelliferae, you know, both of those tend to have really big, broad, upright landing places with very accessible flowers.
Right.
And I think those really work well for a lot of the generalist species. I mean, of course, the insects have been co-evolving with plants for millions of years, and, you know, there are specialists that, you know, have especially long tongues to get nectar out of tube flowers and, you know, ones that are specialized in very small flowers, but there's, you know, big, broad classes of plants that just really appeal widely, and that's definitely one of them. Like Echinacea is another good example in that category.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be very popular.
Do you grow calendulas and
we do
cosmos and what else?
Yeah,
bachelor buttons, right? Is in there
definitely.
Too, right?
All those, all those are really good kind of generalists that we see a lot of different species in. And then there's some like we, for example, grew a new Rudbeckia to us that's it's petalless, so it lacks the what people generally think of as the petals of the flower. Of course, it's a composite, so it's composed of lots of little flowers, but it doesn't have the outer petals that are the ones you'd notice. Instead, it has these tiny little petals, and For that one, we noticed that it was only the little metallic green sweat bees were
yes.
the only bee we would ever see on it. So it's really neat to see the interactions of how some are especially favored by some. And
yeah.
It's interesting to observe the activity and
right.
see who likes what and when.
And who, for instance, in our to our human eyes, you know, what's more attractive, ornamental, or delicious in the case of a vegetable, you know, how we've changed things is for our human tastes often in breeding and selection. And indeed, the scientists explain that, you know, so like we love big, fluffy, double flowers, you know, real puffy and giant. But what you were just talking about, that landing place is sometimes
yeah.
obscured or shifted or configured and doesn't work for the insects. So sometimes the one we like the best is the one that's the least appealing to them. And just to talk about those apetalous echinacea, you know, they don't, you're right, they don't, not as many of them sort of get it. And I think it might have to do, I mean, again, not a scientist, but have to do with the sense of being steered to things, like looking from overhead and going, oh, wait, there's those ray flowers pointing me to that central landing pad. Like, they may not recognize it. You know what I mean? It
yeah.
may be as simple as that, right?
Yeah, and there's also the interesting... interesting fact that there's a whole nother level of UV reflected patterning on flowers
yes.
that is not visible to us, but that totally acts as bullseyes to bees.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I always think of it like the guys who have the two red lights, one in each hand, at the landing strip at the airport. You know, and they're guiding the planes that are taxiing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I always think of those as like that, those markings and those, like you say, the things we can't see. On the flowers as those things.
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Now, sunflowers. You have some sunflowers in the catalog, too?
We do, yeah. We have quite a few. It's always been something that's brought us a lot of joy, growing sunflowers. It's a little less easy to observe the pollinators in the sunflowers because they're up so much higher than the ones you can really, like, get in on. But definitely those, you know, those big discs in the center are just always, always a buzz. And, you know, at our place, there's always so much flowering that if we imagine it as being a pretty dreamy landscape for bees. So the things that are really popular with such a selection available at our farm, I think it's really clear which ones are especially favored and
mm-hmm.
have especially, you know, rich nectar and pollen resources for the bees.
Now, with sunflowers, do you start them indoors and then transplant them, or are you direct sowing? And I know that can be dependent on lots of different, I mean, the decision about that can be. But for gardeners, what do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think, which way?
We've done both.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to just for ease of management, we've switched over the years to try to direct seed as much as we can
uh-huh.
just to save one step in the process. But I think there's a lot of benefits to starting them inside in terms of planting into a weed-free bed, kind of at a later stage of development
yeah.
for having a full bed where you don't have gaps where, you know, some things might have gotten eaten or spotty germination or things like that.
Mm.
So there are benefits to both. We kind of tend towards a more laissez-faire kind of approach these days and direct seed as much as we can.
So another group of plants that when I talk to entomologists and people who specialize otherwise in pollinator stuff, another group of plants that have great sort of beneficial insect appeal are the cousins of the mints, you know, the things, the Apiaceae, the lots of things in the herb garden, you know, bee balm
yeah.
and nepeta and thyme and, of course, the true mints. I think you grow some relatives there, like Eryngium, yes?
Eryngium is great. That was probably, so it's a perennial, and this was our second year with that one. And I would say that was probably the most popular thing with pollinators on the farm this year. And, like, in terms of both numbers and diversity, we saw just tons of different species of beetles, flies. Most of the bee families we have represented at our farm were in there. It's a pretty spectacular plant in bloom and seems equally appealing to the insects. insects as it is to us.
So now you're growing one of the ones that's a sea holly, as they call them, sort of bluish or silvery blue in color.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, silvery blue with kind of spiky, dried appearance to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do have, yeah, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think we have one, I forget where in the United States it's from. I think Oryngium yuccifolium, I think the rattlesnake master, I think that may be an American plant. But that looks a little bit different. It's pure, I think it's ghostly, like silvery.
Yeah, there's several species in that family. And,
yeah.
Yeah, pretty interesting, interesting looks.
And then I think you have some anise hyssops and so forth. I mean, you would imagine you get some interest there.
Yeah, for sure. Anise hyssop is a great one. All the basils when we are also real good with pollinators. We have a low-growing Italian mint called Mentuccia that also is a really, really good nectary plant. And the nice thing about a lot of those is that I think the majority of the perennials in that family, and just perennials in general, tend to have an earlier bloom time. So a lot of what we try to do is not just manage having plants that are popular with insects, but also, you know, having staggered blooms throughout the season so that there's a constant supply for them to feed on and just to have those populations healthy.
Right, and that's really the key. From the earliest thing you can have in bloom to the latest, to have a real succession of opportunities, yeah.
Yeah, especially the early blooming things.
What are some of your really early things that are in bloom on the farm?
Yeah, we've got several. So we always, we grew quite a bit of brassica seed at our place.
Cabbage
kale family, and since that's a biennial,
yeah.
That usually starts blooming in April, and that coincides right about when the bumblebees are coming out kind of in full force, and mm-hmm. those early nectary plants for the bumblebees are really critical for establishing healthy colonies, because
yeah.
those are the queens that have overwintered, and
yeah.
then they start a brood right away. Their first job is to find floral sources and a home, and then they start their brood, which will be, you know, the season's bumblebees. So the success of those early queens that emerge is really critical. Also, another one is Jacob's Ladder, which is...
Polemonium, yeah? Is that what you
yeah,
mean?
Related
yeah,
related to valerian. It's like a valerian family.
Yeah.
For people who are familiar with that one. That's got really lovely kind of sky blue blooms and a really nice architecture, and that one always... I think that was our first blooming plant at the farm this year.
Huh.
That's another good one.
Oh, interesting.
And then we've switched. We used to grow mostly grain cover crops for overwintering.
Uh-huh.
We would grow like a rye mixed with vetch. And more since we would till it in pretty early and not really get that much height or benefit from the rye other than the winter cover, we've switched to clovers, which have the added benefit of having a really good insectary bloom as well. So we grew crimson clover and red clover both, and they, especially when you have it on like an acre scale, it's a really pretty spectacular.
Wow! Yeah, that must be
floral resources.
So you mentioned earlier some of the umbel type flowers. And I think there are probably a lot more, and that's another family that a lot of the entomologists always mention to me as being, you know, having great insect appeal. It's where celery and carrots, I think, parsley, and cilantro, yes, maybe?
Yeah, cilantro, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and actually we sell a pollinator and soil builder mix that is kind of intended to be sort of broadcast sown and just let gone wild in a corner of the garden. And they feature pretty heavily in that mix just because they are so good as sources of both pollen and nectar. And also, cilantro in the garden, people often complain about it bolting, and
yes.
It can be seen as, you know, a resource instead of something to pull up and resew, because it is such a good bee resource.
So that brings up a conversation I had. You mentioned also earlier, before you mentioned how the basils are so popular with some of the pollinators. Mm-hmm. But of course, if we as gardeners want to keep cutting basil leaves, we pinch off the flowers, and so we don't get that experience. And with the cilantro, as you said, it's going to, quote, bolt, so we pull it. Well, then we don't get that experience. So I remember a conversation years ago with Frank Morton of Wild Garden Seed, who I know you like as I do, you know, and respect and whatever, and talking, you know, a lettuce and calendula breeder and various other things. And he said something like, you know, how it was because he started becoming a seed farmer and a seed breeder, you know, watching what happened when you didn't pull out your cilantro because you wanted to get seed from it or whatever the thing was, even the lettuce, watching who showed up, you know, this like amazing number of insects who showed up to enjoy. And he talked about, you know, like micro wasps that parasitize aphids and caterpillars and native fruit pollinating solitary bees, things he hadn't seen otherwise, you know. Syrphids who go after the aphids, or minute pirate bugs for thrip control, and, you know, all these kinds of interesting things that happen. So what would be a few things that we're probably all growing that you would say to us, don't behead it so early, gardeners, let it grow, let it grow on.
Yeah, sure. Frank is a really great teacher of observation and just really being present and observing what's happening in your field. He's always been I've always looked up to him for that.
I
think things like we've already discussed, parsley, a lot of times people will leave parsley to overwinter because it is so winter hardy in a lot of parts of the country, and that as it blooms in the next season is a great thing to leave out. Cilantro is similarly great, and we intentionally companion plant a lot of things in our field for the express purpose of attracting insects. So when we're growing a fall brassica crop to overwinter, most people who grow brassicas in the fall know that aphids are often a terrible problem with that, so we will often put every third bed or so we'll plant to phacelia, which is another plant. It's one of its aliases is bee's friend, which kind of lets you know about what it does in the garden. But and we find that just the syrphid flies, like you mentioned, the parasitic wasps that predate on those aphids, are really beneficial in keeping those populations in check. Alyssum is another really good one that we haven't mentioned. That I know.
Oh, and it's a brassica, too. It's a brassica of all the crazy things, I think, isn't
yeah,
it?
It's yeah, surprising, isn't it? But I know several commercial growers, even on a very large scale, that do that, you know, every fourth row of phacelia, or that do an understory of alyssum in their brassicas just to bring beneficial
brilliant
insects that
brilliant
on them.
Well, Brian Campbell, we've used up all our time. I could talk to you all day.
Yeah.
I'm visualizing those 5 acres of cascading moments of bloom. So thank you so much, Brian Campbell of Uprising Seeds. And I really look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah, thanks, Margaret. It was lovely to talk to you again.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And I look forward to hearing from all the rest of you, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy seed shopping meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.